back, everybody. It's been a few weeks. We have been just crazy busy, Tim and I. We try to schedule a day, and you know, it used to be easy when we did these things every week, but we got so many other things going on, and it's just nuts.
Yeah.
Let's talk. I mean, we're not going to talk about war in the Middle East because nobody tunes in to us for that. You got your 24-hour cable news for that. You're coming here. We're going to.
We thought about recommending some films, but it was too complicated. It's too complicated. To even recommend good films, it's like get you up to speed on what the hell's going on. And there are interesting films out there that would have to be like a 12-film set, and it still wouldn't complete the.
But there is some news, which if you go to scarecrowvideo.org, Scarecrow Video has launched a new rental website for all of you who are mourning the loss of the Netflix disc rental service. Scarecrow Video, they're stepping in and they're filling that space. Granted, they do not have as many titles. And if you were accustomed to finding pretty much anything under the sun over at Netflix, you will not find anything under the sun. But you'll find a lot. If you want to do disc rentals and not actually buy them and not have to deal with digital and digital rental and all that stuff. And a lot of stuff that you can't find elsewhere except on disc. Go to scarecrowvideo.org.
Netflix never had as deep a library as they claimed. Anyway, there's plenty of crap that you could not get a physical rental disc or whatever from Netflix. So that was always a thing that was in our head rather than something that was actually true.
But still, you know, scarecrowvideo.org. It's a good new rental website, scarecrowvideo.org. So go check that out. And then on the
we'll put a link someplace, I guess. I'll just go check it out.
I'll include it on the show rundown. But David McCallum, we lost David McCallum a couple weeks ago.
The man from Uncle.
Yeah, I mean, we remember him from Man from Uncle mainly. He was recently on some other. What was the other show he was recently on for?
He's one of those cop procedurals where he played that scientist, and he was on Fringe. And I love David McCallum.
But Elia, he was Elia.
Man
from Uncle.
Yeah,
and it finally dawned on me that. You know, Man from U.N.C.L.E., what was it about that show that I just found so captivating versus the Avengers and, you know, Mission Impossible and all the other spy shows that were taking advantage of the Bond moment there in the 1960s? And I think it was whenever I saw David McCallum's head, which is much too wide at the top. It's much too wide. Like the crown of his head is at least 2 or 3 inches, just much larger than a normal human being. He almost looks like an alien. And then you put him next to Robert Vaughn, who has a jaw like Jay Leno could live in his jaw. Vaughn jaw. And it was the fact that the two of those heads next to each other looked like some kind of a cartoon. They looked like a cartoonist had drawn kind of a caricature of real people with exaggerated features, except those were the real people. That's what it was. You just see those heads and you're like, I got to see this show. I can't believe these people live in the real world.
It's such a, and it's one of the NCISs, I think, is the answer to that question that you asked. One of those NCISs, and so much stuff, a lot of great voices. And David, I think what I liked about him is that intellectual thing that he brought to it. You know, whether it's the Man from U.N.C.L.E. stuff or the other stuff, he was always there doing a lot of thinking.
Yeah.
And you know, I still appreciate it. Sapphire and Steel. It was something like the Avengers. It was him. And who was it? Oh my gosh, I can't remember who the heck it was, but that was another great one. Anyway, that was kind of cool, like an early 80s kind of thing. I love that stuff. Joanna Lumley, that's who it was.
Joanna Lumley. Yeah. So we are now able to review some stuff from Eureka, which is a UK company, but they are sending us some of their wonderful, wonderful titles. They, of course, do the Masters of Cinema series. And I'm going to blow here through some of the really, really terrific Eureka stuff, most of which is Hong Kong and, you know, Hong Kong martial arts and Japanese genre stuff. But there's a lot of really, really great stuff in here. Junya Sato's film with Ken Takakura, Golgo 13, is quite a fun discovery. I had not seen this, and I find it really quite enjoyable. It made in 1973. It's a, you know, very particular period in Japanese cinema. It's post-Japanese New Wave. It's not really, you know, so-called Japsploitation, but it's a really, really cool film. And, you know, limited edition. There's only 2,000 copies being run. Comes with a collector's booklet and the whole deal. But Ken Takakura, who actually was, the part was written for him. It's pretty great. Based on a manga series, but a really, really great kind of one of those assassin action stories. It's pretty terrific. Golgo 13. Really, really fun stuff. And then there is also Samurai Reincarnation by Kenji Fukasaku. Kenji Fukasaku is most famous for his gangster movies, like Battle Royale is kind of in the gangstery genre. It's more of a you know, Hunger Games thing in Battle Royale, but it's from the present day genre stuff that he does. Samurai Reincarnation is one of his samurai things. Pretty great. It's got, you know, ninjas and magic and all kinds of fun stuff. It's much more genre feudal than something like, you know, a Kurosawa film. Mm. But Samurai Reincarnation, lots of fun. All of the same, just relentlessly bloody Kenji Fukasaku stuff. You'll absolutely love it. We've also got Rich and Famous and Tragic Hero. This is a great double feature from the Hong Kong New Wave. And it's a, you know, it's a gangster thing. It's got, you know, Andy Lau and Chow Yun-Fat are in it. And there's all kinds of, you know, the usual Hong Kong stuff, gambling and, you know, racketeering and all that kind of stuff.
Ah, yeah, baby.
Don't worry about, you know, any of this stuff. This is just a couple of years before The Killer. And it really kind of sets the stage for a lot of that John Woo stuff that's going to come later. So it's really, really, really great. Good, solid action. Bloody as can be, but also, you know, if you love Chow Yun-Fat, if you love Andy Lau, you're going to love it. The Jackie Chan Police Story films are out now. 4K restorations. Really, really outstanding stuff. Police Story 3 is the one that is most famous. But they're all on, you know, Ultra HD, 4K. Terrific. The original Police Story is the one where he slides down the banister in the mall and, you know, scrapes all his, you see in the outtakes at the end, right? He tears his hands up and where I think it was three stuntmen who the bus stops right as he's holding the gun on the bus in the road. And it was supposed to be where they go falling out the top window and they like hit the car. But the bus stopped in the wrong place, so they fell out and they hit the pavement and they broke bones. Every stunt in this film, somebody got actually legit hurt.
Ooh.
Super, you know, Police Story 2 has one of my all-time favorite scenes, which is the kid's playground scene where he's fighting off guys around, you know, jungle gyms and the whole thing. It's amazing, phenomenal. But, of course, you know, Police Story 3, Super Cop, that's where Michelle Yeoh got her great big giant break. And she had done films previously. We're going to talk about some. Mm-hmm. But that was the one that really, you know, she was with Jackie. She held her own. She does the splits in the midair going over somebody. She rides a motorcycle up onto a moving train. It's unbelievable. So all of that on UA.
If you survived the Jackie Chan School of Filmmaking,
oh,
my you God. Got the right to be a movie star.
Yeah,
just indeed. If you survived it. Sammo, the whole shebang.
So true. Burning Paradise is a Ringo Lam film. Ringo Lam, of course, kind of came over to Hollywood for a moment and did like Choi Hawk and John Woo ahead of him. And he made a Van Damme film. And then, of course, he's gone back. And this is a, you know, he used to make gangster films kind of in the John Woo-ish mode, a little bit different. Anyway, this is really interesting. This is kind of a little bit martial arts, a little bit Hong Kong horror. But what's interesting is that the lead character is Fok Sai-yuk, which is kind of, you know, basically the same character as Fong Sai-yuk from the Jet Li movies. And it's completely fictitious, but they're, you know, anytime you have Sai-yuk as a name, it triggers something for audiences. So that's what it is. But
Ringo made a movie with Jean-Claude, Maximum Risk. You remember that one? Late 90s.
Natasha
Henstress. There's a fight scene in that movie that takes place inside an elevator, right?
Yeah, I remember that.
That fight scene in the elevator. Yeah. Dude, that is why I teach that fight scene for beautifully staged fight scene and a close quarters sort of, it's just this brutal, brutal fight scene. Inside, it's just out freaking standing. To this day, it's one of my favorite fight scenes in that Ringo Lam movie.
Ringo knows how to stage some amazing stuff. He really does. He does. We got a bunch of Michelle Yeoh films now that she is an Academy Award winner. We're releasing a lot of her great stuff, like Yes, Madam, in which she stars with Cynthia Rothrock. Magnificent Warriors, which is kind of a mainland Chinese-themed World War II Japanese fighting thing. Not really related to Royal Warriors, which was what preceded it. And but I got to say, you know, Magnificent Warriors was recently on Criterion Channel. Beautiful transfer. This looks even better. Mm. Yes, Madam was also on Criterion after, you know, she had won the Oscar. Terrible transfer. This Blu-ray is phenomenal. Yes, Madam has the big finale in the in kind of these it's again a shopping mall thing where she and Cynthia Rothrock are just going at it against the bad guys. It's unbelievable, unbelievable stuff.
Awesome.
And then we also have, as long as we're speaking about Cynthia Rothrock, we've got Lady Reporter and which is also known here as The Blonde Fury. Lady Reporter was the original Hong Kong title, and Blonde Fury is how it was released outside of Hong Kong. In any case, it's absolutely great. If you were Caucasian and you made it into a Hong Kong martial arts film, that meant you were legit because you had to be up to their level. And Cynthia Rothrock was. She's not a contact martial artist. She's a forms martial artist, which means it's, you know, she learned to do forms. It's all kind. It's not fighting martial arts. It's kind of presentation, acrobatic martial
katas,
katas, and all that stuff. But she's great at it, and this is a really, really fun film. Lots of really great stuff in here. Directed by Corey Yun, you know, Jackie Chan's old pal who did so many of these other great films. It's really, really good. Let me go through just some of these real fast so that I don't spend too much time on the rest of them. We've got Beach of the War Gods. This is a Jimmy Wang Yu title, which is like, gosh, got to be late 1970s. Jimmy Wang Yu, of course, Tim and I have done a commentary for one of his movies, and you know, he made a lot of great films in the 60s and 70s. This is one of them, so this is worth checking out. Nice kind of period Chinese thing.
Yeah.
Beijing with Love with Stephen Chow is hysterical. This is a James Bond spoof with Stephen Chow as the dorkiest, weirdest, most psychotic spy imaginable.
I was like that. I remember that early 90s, right?
Yeah,
he's a
butcher until he gets called up to be a spy. He sits around and he brings the big butcher cleaver with him. That's his secret weapon, and it's really a little bit scary. And there is a scene in here I cannot even describe on this show because it's not appropriate, because it's so crude and it's so hilarious. So from Beijing with Love, one of the funniest spy spoofs, maybe the funniest spy spoof ever to come out of Hong Kong for sure. And then we've also got The Prodigal Son, which is one of the all-time... This is from Arrow, by the way, not Eureka, but I'm including it here. The Prodigal Son, one of the all-time great classic Hong Kong films from the Hong Kong New Wave era. She Shoots Straight. This is back to Eureka now. She Shoots Straight with Karina Lau and a special appearance by Sammo Hung. Also, absolutely one of the great kind of feminist... actioners that they, you know, Karina Lau is, you know, not up to Michelle Yeoh standards, but, or Cynthia Rothrock, but awful lot of fun anyway. And then, no, Jackie Chan and Jet Li are not the only actors to portray Wong Fei-Hung. Wong Fei-Hung was portrayed by Quan Tak-Hing in 1974 in the movie The Skyhawk, which also starred Carter Wong and Sammo Hung. And I had never seen this. And do I prefer Quan Tak-Hing to Jackie or Jet? No, not by a mile. But you know what? It's a really fun film. It's pretty great. Another 1970s era classic. And then just two more. In the Line of Duty 4 is along with In the Line of Duty 3. I don't know why 1 and 2 weren't released, but this is another great longstanding series with Donnie Yen and Cynthia Khan. This is one reason why Michelle Yeoh, who was momentarily known as Michelle Khan, changed her name so as to not be confused with the equally excellent Cynthia Khan who preceded her. But Cynthia Khan also very, very good in the two In the Line of Duty films. And then, yes, we do finally have Royal Warriors, the other Warriors film from what I just mentioned. Anyway, both Magnificent Warriors and Royal Warriors. So those are the two Michelle Yeoh Warriors movies. They have nothing to do with each other, but they're both absolutely terrific. And then lastly, Eureka is also releasing a lot of Buster Keaton films, all of which are available here in multiple versions there. So you can take your pick. There's the Kino stuff, which looks really, really good. There's the Coen stuff, which also looks really, really good. And that all comes from a separate library. And then there's another library that is being used to release all of this wonderful Blu-ray stuff from Eureka in the UK. And the one I'm mentioning here is The Three Ages, which is that was Buster Keaton's first feature length film. And it's really, really good. Anyway,
the Keaton stuff really goes great with the Jackie Chan stuff.
Actually. It does. And that's why I'm including it here, because this is the 100th anniversary of Buster Keaton's directing debut. So it's worth checking out. The Three Ages, a whole lot of fun. So this is probably going to be our Halloween show as well. I don't know if we'll get to another show before Halloween. So we've got a ton of 4Ks. A lot of them are Halloween themed. Should we dive into those, Tim?
Let's do those. We're going to get to those criterions, because there are a few criterions I definitely want to talk about. So we're going to bump into the 4Ks.
Yeah, let's bump into the 4Ks. And you know what I want to do? I'm going to deviate a little bit here, because I want to. I want to talk about, because I'm going to pull something out of the TV stack. So we've got The Flash, the movie, that kind of tanked this last summer on 4K. And then we also have the ninth and final season of The Flash on television, which Tim and I, of course, have been fond of since it began nearly a decade ago. So let's compare and contrast these two, because here's my big problem with The Flash, the movie, if I can point this out. And I've mentioned this to people. Is that if you saw season 3 of The Flash on television, it's basically the same story as the movie.
Oh, well, yes, because of the going back I guess we're not doing spoilers. You can't really do spoilers, can you?
Yeah, look, the big twist as to, who is that guy who's attacking him in the Speed Force? Who is that person? Well, if you watch season 3 of the TV show, you know exactly who that is, and it's not a surprise when it happens. And that sort of surprised me, that Warner Brothers would not have seen that problem coming. It's like the two worlds did not even connect. And this Flash movie is so obsessed with tying in all these other universes, there's all this DC stuff that gets surprised by all the way the multiverses connect. Like, everybody knows, he teams up with Michael Keaton's Batman because it's a different universe. And, you know, there's another universe where there's no Superman, but there's a Supergirl, and she steals this movie. I thought she was great.
Yeah, yeah.
But they wrap in all this other Superman and Batman lore. I mean, you know, when you see Adam West and Burt Ward kind of show up in the background, you roll your eyes a little bit. But the one universe that they don't actually tie in correctly is the TV Flash.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is weird, because on like season, was it 7 or something, where the movie Flash showed up for a moment on the TV Flash.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Totally. But they don't repay the loop. They don't loop it back around. Look, all of that is so true. But you know I am. But here's my problem with this Flash, the Flash.
Yeah, the movie.
It's ugly.
It is, isn't it?
It's visually displeasing, almost always. Almost always, particularly when that whole melange of things are coming at you, you know, and you know what I'm talking about. Yeah. But really, just in any given moment in that film, it's literally visually displeasing. It hurts my eyes. It's an ugly movie to look at, and it gets uglier the more kinetic it gets. Narrative, all the narrative stuff you said, absolutely, but I just didn't like looking at this movie. I just, you know, so, and that really disappointed me.
I agree. And you know, I mean, it's interesting, because they were always very concerned about how he would play, how Ezra Miller's indiscretions in regular life would impact what happens in the movie. And, you know, I can put that stuff aside. Like, he can be the biggest jerk in life. I'll be willing to suspend it and, you know, give him a solid shot in the movie, because sometimes actors need to just be who they are on screen, and that way they can cope with who they are in real life. But I don't, I didn't find it great casting. To be honest, I know, you know, we saw him in, you know, Justice League, and he had done, you know, the previous stuff, and that was fine. And I really like Zack Snyder's Justice League director's cut. I like that 4-hour film, and I think he's very good in it. But here, that whole, like, you know, playing off your goofy old self, which seemed to me like a kind of like a cheat of what Michael Keaton did in Multiplicity, which I thought was great. I love Multiplicity.
No, I love it.
Didn't work for me. It just didn't work. Like, oh, there's my goofy pre-Flash self. I just could never wrap myself around it. And again, I think they could have done better with the plot. They really could have done better with the plot. And it wound up not making much money at all.
Well, no, did very, very, very poorly, and for a whole lot of different reasons, some of which had to do with Ezra and his shenanigans, most of it of which had to do with just people not particularly caring for the movie, the narrative, the stories the film was communicating, and a great look. Best thing in the movie, though, Kara Zor, but also Michael Keaton. You know what I really learned from this Flash? It's that I only ever needed the one Batman. Michael Keaton could have been playing Batman for me for the last almost 40 years. If he had played every Batman and every Batman movie made, no matter who the director was, Michael Keaton could have held on to both physically, presentation. He could have played the arc of the character, obviously, because he's aged, you know, 25, 30 years old. So he could have played the whole arc. I believed him every bit as much as old ass Batman in this movie. All these Batmans we've had, and I only ever needed the one.
It is an interesting thing because I was never a fan of him originally, but I love him in this. Isn't that interesting?
Batman would have become after 30 freaking years of being Batman, 35 years of being Batman, you'd have become that guy. I just used to be fun, but now, you know.
Well, let's talk now that the grand romance of Barry and Iris has come to a close in the ninth season, and I thought this show... I love the first few seasons of this show. I thought around late season six, it was starting to run on some fumes, and 7, 8, and 9 have just been kind of treading water. And God bless it. I mean, you know, bringing Chester on to replace Sisko. I'm okay with it because I like the actor that they brought in for Chester. I think he didn't try to be Sisko, right? He did his own thing, but he's still being that part of the team. But just too many characters on this show became meta at a certain point.
Yeah.
It was just everybody was meta. Everybody had powers. And it just got a little crowded in the room.
Hey, look, and then they were around for a while. Look, we have the whole thing with Zora, her the daughter and the son and from the future and all this kind of stuff. And I was never particularly crazy about that little bending of time and space. And because it makes things like very complicated to say the least. But I was never crazy about that. But okay, dealt with all that. By the time we get to I think everybody but Joe. Dad. I think everyone with Joe got powers, and Joe toward the end of the last Joe and Chester. Chester's super smart, but no power. Yeah. And Joe was just Joe. He's just a cop, regular cop. I went to a state college. Yeah. I got no powers. I'm good. I've been solving crimes here. And by the time we get to the end of this, Joe's like, you know what, guys, I'm gonna take the kid. we're moving out to the farm. You guys go ahead and hold this down. And I'm like, that guy is talking sense. I thought about that. Joe was like, this shit is crazy. I'm getting out of here.
So a couple other 4Ks here, as long as on the superhero kick. Now we're into some animated stuff. So Batman Mask of the Phantasm on 4K. It's another, DC original. Looks great. Respectably written. It's from the Batman animated series universe. The Joker comes back, which is always nice. There's something really classic about the Joker. I just don't know that this is giving us much that's new. On the other hand, Spider-Man Across the Spider-Verse, the second of the Spider-Verse films in the trilogy, the first one, of course, won an Academy Award for Best Animation, and it deserved to. How do we feel about this now that they are going into this kind of multiverse craziness? I mean, the first one opened up the multiverse, but now... you've got this character here who becomes kind of a multiverse villain, and it just goes bonkers. Tim,
the notion of the multiverse is problematic at this point, period.
Yeah.
I'm being ridiculously unfair as a child of the original Star Trek series, where every now and again we go right. to and the ones with mustaches and goatees were the bad guys.
Yeah, mirror,
all those kinds of stuff like that. So maybe I'm being a crank about this, but I think that the notion of the multiverse has become a crutch, one of the many crutches that live inside of all of these various, whether it's the Marvel over here or the DC over there, whatever it is. When they start multiversing you, that's when you know they're running out of ideas.
Yeah.
To me, the multiverse is an indicator of ideas are getting thin.
Yeah, I agree. I agree. The weird thing, though, is what occurred to me, because I saw these like on successive nights, Spider-Man Across the Multiverse is basically the same movie as The Flash.
Again?
Except it does the way they tell that multiverse story is better. But yeah, the movie Flash, it's the third season of the TV show, but the general story structure is basically Spider-Man Across the Spider-Verse, except it does it better. Now, I still think this movie has problems. I think it's way too busy. It gave me a headache. It's just...
The same way I felt about Flash. Too busy.
It's just because it's trying to capture that comic book page look where everything is a frame on the page, right? Like, you get to some pages in a comic book, and there are like 7 or 8 or 9, 10 frames, and there's something outrageous happening in all of them. And it's kind of visual overload, and it takes you a moment to kind of work your way through it if you're a comic reader. But when you animate each of those frames and then you put them all on the screen at the same time, you're going to give me a migraine.
Exactly. And it's all moving too fast, and things get missed. And like you said, that multiverse dynamic does put you into this sort of narrative flow that's going to loop you through the sort of same things happening over and over and over again. Things that have to do with meeting yourself, things that have to do with meeting other versions of the things that have to do with changing the timeline, things that have to do with blah, 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 all of that. Yeah. And I don't know, if you see it coming, you see it coming.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. So we got three little pieces of 4K here before we get into the Halloween stuff, but I want to also mention a Best Buy exclusive from Lionsgate, for the movie Fall, unrated version of Fall in a steelbook packaging only at Best Buy. This is from Lionsgate. And I'm a little bit surprised that they went for a big 4K steelbook for this, because almost nobody had heard of this thing. But it is, this is the rock climber movie, right? It's kind of a young adult oriented story, but it's really very well shot. Like, the 4K is well served by the whole, idea of climbing to, 2000 feet up to the top of this radio tower. And then, having to figure out how you're going to make your way back down. And there's a whole thing here, but I don't know. Is this really like a? I mean, people who buy 4Ks, are they going to go for this steelbook? I don't know.
Interesting. I mean, I'm not a rock climbing guy.
Yeah,
That's but a thing. But heights or whatever. This doesn't really do it for me.
Unless there's a market for young adult book readers and movie viewers that really craves 4K adaptations like this. I mean, maybe I'm not into it anyway. Three movies that are, semi-recent, recent-ish within the last couple of decades, that are now out on 4K. Legend of Zorro, which was the second of the Antonio Banderas and Catherine Zeta-Jones Zorro movies. Promising Young Woman, which is absolutely superb. And then the original Elizabeth by Shekhar Kapoor, starring Cate Blanchett as Queen Elizabeth I. Which is one of my favorite films of like the past 20 some years.
Yeah, Kate has been notable before that, but that film made her, kind of put her in that upper Meryl Streepish, level or range.
Really did. It's a great film. And Shekhar Kapoor had been a favorite director of mine for a while. He had done Bandit Queen, which I saw at Cannes in '93, I want to say. And that put him over the top in the Indian film industry. It got released here. It was my number one film of the year when it got released here. And Hollywood took notice. And his career is a little bit stagnated now because he did The Four Feathers and it didn't do well. But boy, I'll tell you, he just nailed it and knocked it out of the park with Elizabeth. And I still think this is one of the best period films of the last, 30, 40 years. It's
gorgeous movie too. Yeah. Oh,
she is so phenomenal in it. And Promising Young Woman, by the way, both of them, and Legend of Zorro, they all have Movies Anywhere digital codes. Mm. So you can add them. Promising Young Woman, boy, let's just talk for a second, because last year I loved She Says, which is the expose on the Harvey Weinstein thing. Mm-hmm. And Promising Young Woman kind of, it got a good little awards attention, but not a ton of money at the box office, because it's kind of going in that same direction, right? She's a woman who's trying to, seek revenge for a rape that had occurred, and I think everybody knows the story. Emerald Fennell wrote and directed, terrific writer, excellent screenplay, really just brutal film on the whole Me Too moment. But we have breaking news as well on the Harvey Weinstein thing, by the way, the Julia Ormond lawsuit this week, I should have mentioned at the top of the show. For those who don't know, Julia Ormond has now come out years after everybody else came out and is now suing Harvey Weinstein for sexual assault. And I think calling it assault as opposed to rape is pretty charitable. But she's suing him. And here's the twist.
Yes.
She's also suing CAA and Disney and Miramax for enabling it.
The breach of protection. Very interesting. Yeah,
that'll be a game changer. I mean, she prevails on that. That changes everything.
Yeah, particularly with respect to Harvey. Yeah, whatever. Yeah. But with respect to those, the CAA, that agency, particularly that now, agency,
like Salma Hayek's husband.
Salma, who was probably sexually harassed by Harvey Weinstein
as well.
Like very, very interesting set of events.
Legend of Zorro. How does this compare to the original?
It's not the original, but I appreciate it. I appreciated both Antonio and what's his name? I haven't seen him in a while.
Anthony Hopkins.
Yeah. In that original Legend of Zorro. For one thing, I bought Anthony Hopkins as that original Zorro. Anthony was probably my age at the time, 60 some odd years old. He sold it that he was still that sort of capable. Yeah. By the time he gets to this, even Antonio's a little long in the tooth to be running around in that black outfit. But it's okay. What do you think?
You know what? I remember liking it okay. I didn't love it, but it didn't sort of destroy the memory of the previous one. I didn't think it was nearly as good as the first one, but it was fine. It was adequate. Revisiting those characters. So three more here, which are a little bit more in the exploitation-y vein. Kiss the Girls, not really an exploitation film, but it is not, as Morgan Freeman and Ashley Judd, not up to other serial killer stories. Certainly not in the same league as Silence of the Lambs or Seven, but it's not bad. Gary Flader did a decent job with it, and Morgan Freeman always makes you believe that you're watching a better movie than you are.
Yeah, that's what it is, isn't it? Yeah,
it is. That's what it is. It's just he brings that gravitas, and you buy into it. Like you look at that face, and you go, "All right, you buy it, I'll buy it."
Yeah,
and there it is.
Look, Ashley Judd was something of an ingenue at the time. And those James Patterson novels, this is another one of the James Pattersons. I guess Morgan played this character once or twice for James. I think Tyler Perry played him one. This is a detective character that's in a whole bunch of James Patterson.
That's right. Yes, yes, yes.
And this may have been one of the first ones. What's funny is you can't really make this kind of film, even with the weight of a Morgan Freeman in the lead, let alone Ashley Judd, as a feature film anymore. These are not feature films anymore. These are streaming films now.
Yeah.
But back in 97, it was a big movie.
Sure was. Sure was. And then we also have Cocaine Bear on 4K. I ripped the daylights out of this thing on radio. I mean, what an unfortunate movie to be one of Ray Liotta's last films. But some people have told me now, because I was on with Christy, and Christy loved it. She's like, I love me some Cocaine Bear. And Christy's much more forgiving of this stuff than I am. She's got a much more populist sensibility. And everybody's told me you're too tough on it. It's just messing around. I'm like, yeah, but it's not. Here's the problem. It's too gory and it's not funny.
No.
I mean, am I wrong?
It's definitely too gory for me. My problem with it was that it was too gory. Had it been way less gory, I mean, you know, O'Shea Jackson with the hand and all this kind of, and been more funny than I would have liked. It's kind of like, what was that one about the tire, the killer tire, rubber.
Rubber, yeah.
Yeah, you know, see, made you giggle right there. Yeah, already. And but the bear, the effects, all of that kind of stuff, but it's just too gory. It just, I would like this movie if the bear never killed anybody.
Yeah, I agree. Know, just,
I agree. Did I like it?
And the thing is, you know, Elizabeth Banks directed this and really needs to kind of get the tone right in her movies, because they claim like this is based on real events. Well, I know you are always ripping on the real events thing. Here's the real event. Somebody dropped some cocaine out of a plane, and a bear found it. And I guess the bear like died or did something, whatever. A bear found it. Bear didn't go on a rampage and start killing people. So basically the portion of this movie that bears any relationship to real life, I might as well say that The Godfather is about my life. it's about like people. I mean, it's about people who have dinner. There you go.
that's the whole big thing. Anyway. Yeah, I don't know. I'm trying to think of something that I would compare it to that got it right in terms of tone by me, like I said, Rubber or something like that. But that's about, yeah. I don't know.
Yeah. No, Rubber's a good one. Mm. And then we've also got a Blue Underground UHD 4K of an old Jess Franco kind of spy Barbarella thing called The Girl from Rio. I had forgotten this movie even existed. This is such a weird movie, but it may be one of the most accomplished and professional and good films that Jess Franco ever made. Because usually Jess Franco would make movies where people are just kind of partially naked and acting very badly. And this really does try to be much more in that Barbarella vein, that Danger Diabolique. All the Bond spoofs of that era. And it's, you know what? I mean, it's a little bit over the top, but really, I kind of had a lot of fun with it. It's, you know, it's stylish and it's well shot, and Franco suddenly knows where to put the camera and gets you some really good visuals. And, George Sanders is pretty great in it. You know,
he just
nails it.
A city full of nothing but fine ass women, Italian chicks mostly. Yes. That's it, you know. I mean, right there, I'm like, go ahead, string it up. Let's play. We're in the movie. what are you? Whatever. But that's a lot of fun. I dig that movie.
You know, we've got also, there is a part of the, you know, Warner Brothers is releasing all of their classics on 4K now in the 100th anniversary run. And the original William Friedkin, our dear late friend William Friedkin, the original The Exorcist, is now on 4K UHD the very same week that the latest Exorcist, or the attempt at a kind of semi long distance sequel with.
Is it a sequel or is it a reconception of the original? Is that the way David Gordon Green thought? Well, I mean, what do you?
Ellen Burstyn kind of.
She shows up in the movie. Is she the same? Okay, yeah.
Yeah, I don't really understand why this new one. Like, gosh, he made George Washington.
Yeah.
Why? How? Go back to making those movies.
Oh, he also made How High. And I was wondering if he was doing here what he did with the Halloween movies. You know, where he just sort of like, you know,
yeah,
more or less, you know, started over and did. I don't know.
Well, this has the extended director's cut and the original theatrical cut, both of them on it, so you can make your mind up to which one you prefer. But this movie still works. It still totally works. The music works. The effects work. Max von Sydow is tremendous in it. Everything works. I mean, it's just, you know, this movie was, I remember this as a kid, it was a total sensation. People were lines around the block. It was one of those first kind of movies in the 70s that really just lit people up, and it was a whole new movie going experience, and still works, man.
Yeah, yeah. Bill never cared for calling it a horror movie, though. When one included it in the ranks of, you know, what we classically call horror movies.
Yeah.
He really never cared. No Frankenstein, no, you know, Dracula, or all of that kind of stuff. He a drama to him. It's a drama.
Now we also have a 4K release collector's edition from Shout Select, Volume 147. Gosh, we've got there quickly. Of Natural Born Killers, Oliver Stone's adaptation of the Quentin Tarantino screenplay, which Quentin never they went Splitsville on this. Quentin didn't like the movie. He didn't like what Oliver Stone did with it. He hated what he did with it, in fact. So, you know, is it more a Quentin film? Is it more an Oliver Stone film? That's the debate. This held the top spot of my worst film ever made list for a long time. It displaced Ken Russell's Gothic, and it was eventually displaced by Postal. Uwe Boll's unwatchable, just piece of garbage. But I really dislike this movie. However, I recognize what Stone was going for, that he was going for something completely unhinged and psychedelic and, you know, otherworldly. And so over time, I've cut it a little bit of slack. I'd forgotten Robert Downey Jr. was in it entirely. Didn't remember that at all. But I still think it's too much.
Well, you know, it's cultural commentary, 1994.
Yeah.
And it's all about cultural commentary, about the media creating the sensation and the media becoming the story and the story, and, you know, all that kind of stuff, you know. So, you know, I don't know that if it captured the reality of the culture of that moment, you know, everything sort of being, particularly given what things have become today. But the intention of the movie, I always appreciated. It struck me as a movie about from a filmmaker looking at the culture and saying, yeah, the culture is sort of shaped in a certain way. I'm going to take all of that, turn it up to 11, and see what happens. Robert Downey played that reporter, you know, sort of becomes a part of the. But sort of interesting sort of thing, kind of like Man Bites Dog a little bit, I guess.
For my money, the better movie was the one that came out not too many months earlier. That was California with Brad Pitt.
Oh, with Brad and
K. California with a K. Yeah,
with a K. Yeah, with Brad and who? Juliette Lewis?
Juliette Lewis is in this one.
Is in this one. Who's in that one with Brad?
Oh gosh, who was it? Yeah, I can only remember Brad Pitt.
David. It was David.
No, it is Juliette Lewis. It is Juliette Lewis. No, it was Juliette Lewis. In both of them. Isn't that weird? Why did I forget that?
It's strange. Yeah, it stuck in my head too. I forgot David Duchovny was in it. Yeah. Foxy, anyway. Yeah, interesting. Well,
all right. Well, anyway, and then we also have, before we get into the Halloween-y stuff, we've got Orson Welles' Touch of Evil from Eureka.
Oh, I love
an amazing UHD volume of Touch of Evil.
Which one? Is the one that they put back together from his notes? Or the...
So this includes three versions, and they all have Dolby Vision HDR, which is just spectacular. It has the theatrical version, the preview version, and the 1998 reconstruction, all three of them. And it's really amazing. And there are four audio commentaries, interviews, extras. I mean, this is like Criterion level stuff. So three versions of this film, and you can make your own mind up. But it really is a legendary film. Orson Welles had already let himself go by this time. You know, the film gets mocked a little bit because Charlton Heston as a Mexican is. Let's just leave it there. Charlton Heston plays a Mexican. That's a problem. But the film itself has that amazing opening shot, and you know, it has this limited edition 100-page book that is just tremendous. It's got essays in it by everybody imaginable, Truffaut and Bazin and. It really just goes to the mat and tells you why this is a great film. And then you can watch the three versions and figure out which one you prefer.
Again, Orson is doing cultural commentary. You know, yeah. Everything that's going on in that movie is cultural commentary. I don't mind Charlton playing Mexican in that movie. This is 1958, so you know, this is a very ordinary sort of thing. I do mind Orson Welles' fake-ass nose. That's no excuse for that, dude. Come on, dude. I love that movie.
So let's get into some Halloween-y stuff. We have a whole bunch of interesting steelbook collections from Lionsgate, and they all have the digital copy thing. And one of them is Halloween 1 and 2, the Rob Zombie versions.
Ah, the Rob Zombie stuff, okay.
The Rob Zombie ones, right? The Rob Zombie Halloween 1 and 2, which are, you know, they kind of have their, they're the most recent, and they, you know, Zombie, put aside his horrible Monsters movie, he really does kind of capture something here in the way that he redoes these. And then as it happens, we also have out on 4K from Paramount via Miramax, Halloween H2O 20 years later, which is supposed to kind of bring the whole thing to a close. So the original series with Jamie Lee Curtis, now an Oscar winner, 20 years later, you know, this is the 25th anniversary of Halloween H2O.
I was going to say Halloween 20 year H2O 20 years later. It was 25 years ago, right?
Yeah. Yeah, so yes, exactly. So, you know, the Rob, anyway, I'm rambling here. I'm trying to sort of make sense of this. So you have the Rob Zombie reboot of the two, and then the 20 years later film from 25 years ago, which is supposed to bring the original series kind of to a close, but of course it didn't really. So, I don't know the whole Halloween universe, and that's putting aside the original Halloween, was it 3 that was the year of the witch that had nothing to do with anything Halloween?
Yep, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. Yes. 1 and 2. John Carpenter's 1 and 2. The film that he made them back to back. Those are the only two of the Halloween films you need to pay any attention to, but in my opinion. The rest of it, you knock yourself out with.
Closes out the chapter.
Yeah.
We also have Rob Zombie's Firefly trilogy. Which I don't know that I had paid much attention to as a trilogy, but it's comprised of House of 1,000 Corpses, The Devil's Rejects, and 3 from Hell. Were you aware of the fact that this was a trilogy?
I did not know that he conceived them as a trilogy and executed them as a trilogy. I never did. House of 1,000 Corpses, I always thought was just an outstanding film. But I always thought of it as a standalone film.
So here's the weird thing. Like, apparently, the characters in these films, this tells you how poor the filmmaking is. The characters here, Baby Firefly, Otis Driftwood, Captain Spaulding, Sheriff Wydell, and other characters are common across these films. I don't know that I even realized.
I don't know that I knew that either. I knew the actors, because his wife, she's in all his movies. Until Sid died, he was in all his movies. Sid Haig was all his movies. So I don't know that I knew that they were playing the same people in all those movies.
We have the Blair Witch Project and the Blair Witch. Now, the Blair Witch is a very, very poor follow-up. There's really no point to that whatsoever. But the original Blair Witch Project, anyway, these are also together in a steelbook from Lionsgate. My question for you, Tim Cogshell, does the original Blair Witch, with its fantastic gimmick, and it was a great gimmick, but does it still hold up?
Well, if you see it for the first time. And you haven't seen every sort of movie that grew out of it in the last 25 years, I guess it is. Then all by itself, found footage, all that kind of stuff. The notion is really, really still interesting. Now we've had a lot of these since then, or something like them, does it hit that way now? Not so much. Yeah. Not so much. But what are you going to do? That's the thing about these things. They really do. Only really, really, really work the first time. Now, you and I are both old enough to remember that when the marketing for this was brilliant, because it really led you to believe, before deep internet, there was internet, but not deep internet the way we have it now.
Yeah.
The marketing really led even film professionals like us to believe that this was a found footage film. It really leaned into it hard, and you had to put on your super deep skeptical cap in order to realize, you know, what was going on here. And it was just so effective that people just sort of leaned into it.
Tim, there is a boxed set, another steelbook from Lionsgate, which contains the following films. Now, you tell me if you feel like this is something people should run out and see. Let's see if this is something people should run out and see. Leprechaun, Leprechaun 2, Leprechaun 3, Leprechaun 4 in Space, Leprechaun in the Hood, Leprechaun Back to the Hood, THA, Leprechaun Origins, and Leprechaun Returns.
Well, look. First of all, Leprechaun, first one. Jennifer Aniston's in that movie.
I forgot that.
Young Jennifer Aniston, fine as hell in that movie. That could have told her, I could have told her, hey, baby, you're going to be a star. It was just Mark Jones. I know Mark Jones from way back in the day. But Jennifer Aniston in the movie. But once you get past Jennifer there, and you know, Warwick Davis places that I was like, Warwick is like, but you look, one Leprechaun movie is all you really need.
I feel like being quarter Irish, I should be offended on some level, but I can't. I can't.
Hey, know? Dude, Leprechaun in the Hood, I should be offended. but that's okay.
And then we have the last of the Steel books here from this Lionsgate series includes Saw 2, Saw 3, Saw 4, Saw 5,
hate them all,
and Saw 6,
hate them all,
and Saw 6 and Saw the Final Chapter, which, as anyone who's been paying attention knows, it was not the final chapter because there's Saw 10 that just came out. So. Yeah. Never listen to that, because I think Friday the 13th chapter 4 was supposed to be the final chapter. And
it was 25 years ago. Look, I never liked any of these movies. It's not my thing. You know, James Wan and Lee and everything. It's not my kind of movie.
No,
just genre wise. So that's the only thing I'm really saying when I say I don't like them. I don't care for the genre. I didn't care for it back in the days of Dario. Dario was making the same thing, relatively speaking. You know, torture of one sort or another for a reason. Torture porn is just not my thing. But apparently 10 movies later, you know, it's somebody's thing.
Well, as long as we're talking about Dario, Synapse has given us the 4K Ultra HD version of Tenebrae that we've always wanted. Not, yeah. And, I have said many times in this show, I'm sorry, I apologize to Dario Argento fans, not a fan of you know, Giallo or Yalo or however you pronounce it. They're really not a fan of Argento at all, not at all. But in 1982, he made a film that set people on fire, and I know people who swear by this and they think I'm a heretic. And does it look good? I guess it's 4K, it's splashy, it's, you know, blood splashy, but you know, I mean, it's freaking Tenebrae. You know, Anthony Franciosa is just not, he's not good in it. He's just not. I mean, look, for those who don't know, he's about a novelist and he goes to Rome, and there's some lunatic in Rome who's on the loose. And the question is, why does this movie take place? Oh, well, of course, because, you know, Dario is Italian. He didn't want to shoot the movie anywhere else. So he's like, I'm going to shoot it in Rome just because. So let's get an American to come to Rome and we'll make up an excuse for why this movie's in Rome. Okay, fair enough. Anyway, so, you know, it's like Murder, She Wrote, except it's a guy and it's not really interesting.
Yeah. John Saxon's in that movie, Robert Collins. John Saxon?
Yeah,
I think John's running around.
Yeah, it's just really deeply unpleasant, but it's loaded with extras. And if you want to watch the movie and then endure like 5 or 6 hours worth of extras, go knock yourself out.
Look, it's Dario, whatever, in razors. He has a thing with razors and eyeballs and razors and, you know, whatever. Yeah, okay.
We also have 4Ks of all the relevant Chucky films, and that would be set. Yes. I mean, it's not the original Child's Play, but these are kind of the Chucky these are the movies. Ones. Yeah. These are the ones that get campy. Let's put it that way. These are the ones where it gets really fun and much more campy, which includes Cult of Chucky, Curse of Chucky, Bride of Chucky, and Seed of Chucky.
Seed of Chucky.
This is all from Shout Factory, all on 4K. And I have to say my true favorite, maybe the only one of these that I like, is Bride of Chucky, because it was directed by Ronnie Yu, another one of the great Hong Kong New Wave directors, directed The Bride with White Hair in Hong Kong, tremendous director. And he came to the whole Chucky thing and just said, so I don't know what this Chucky thing is. It's some American deal, but I'm just going to do what I do. And he basically made a Ronnie Yu movie. And Jennifer Tilly is terrific in it. And yeah, it's got some Chucky stuff in it. It's kind of spoofing, you know, Bride of Frankenstein a little bit, and Katherine Heigl's in it, and John Ritter even shows up. And it's a really, really, really fun film. It's just fun. The rest of them, not so much.
Well, I like whenever Jennifer Tilly's in, she's in two or three of them. I think she's in Seed of Chucky. Whenever I'm nuts about Jennifer Tilly, but other than that, yeah, Chucky.
Yeah, and see, the others are all directed by Don Mancini, who kind of does his same thing over and over, and they're fine, and there's a lot of
Wasn't there just a recent Chucky?
They reinvented him, so he's not possessed. Yeah. But the latest Chucky, it's so stupid. He's not possessed by like the spirit of a murdered killer.
Now it's
like a whole AI thing. Like somebody spilled coke on the chip at the Chinese factory, and it now made Chucky a murderer. It's okay. The dumbest thing ever. Yeah, it's whatever.
Yeah.
I want to get to let's cover Night of the Demons. Let's just kick that out.
Oh, yeah.
And then we'll get to the fun stuff. So we have Night of the Demons, Night of the Demons 2. Night of the Demons is 4K. Night of the Demons 2 is not. Not that that should matter. These are both from Shout Factory, Scream Factory. No real point to these movies, honestly. They are the only thing that is kind of relevant is that Night of the Demons 2 was directed by Brian Trenchard-Smith, who is a very, very good kind of mid-level B director, made a lot of great classics, and he kind of brings a little bit more of a campy sensibility to the sequel than was in there in the original, directed by Kevin Tenney. Mm-hmm. So this is a film that I think gets better in the sequel because it's a lot more fun. It's like Gremlins. I love Gremlins 2. I hate Gremlins 1 because it's funny.
Yeah.
So that's all I want here. But also loads of special features. I wish the sequel was also 4K. Not that it super needs it or anything. But, it's got its moments.
Yeah. I see the blackening.
Let's do it. Let's hit the blackening.
Over there. I'm
saving that one for near the last. Because this, I remember when you saw this and I texted you and I said, how was it? And you said, hilarious.
Absolutely hilarious.
And you're right. It is unbelievably funny. This thing is so stinking funny. I just want to cry.
It's just that ridiculously sort of self-aware sort of thing. I imagine that most of these jokes, you don't necessarily have to be black to find funny.
No,
but if you happen to be black, they're really freaking funny.
But the fact that it's all set on a Juneteenth weekend celebration makes it so hysterical.
At a cabin in the woods. First joke in the movie. Who the hell booked this? Black people don't go to cabins in the woods. Who booked this? You know, and it's first joke in the movie. And we do that all the way through the movie. It's hysterical.
Oh, it's so good. It's so good. I mean, it really, it what's amazing is that they there's not a single joke that they shy away from.
No.
The not so obvious ones, they just sat down and they just said, what are the jokes? Like let's make a list of every joke we can come up with. And they put them all in there. And you know what? It winds up being, and Tim Story, let's give props.
Oh, yes, Tim. Yeah.
Because Tim Story is a hell of a director. He really is. And you know, whenever he's given us a film that was not so hot, like the Fantastic Four film, it's because they handed him a bad script. But Tim is a good, solid director, especially when he's got a good cast and he can work the cast. He can work it like clay. And he does that here. And the timing is perfect. Everything is just so spot on.
Yeah, your barbershops, you think like a man. That's all Tim. Back in his bailiwick, it's what it kind of is. I dig it.
It is a lot of fun. And it's a great cast. No, for sure. And also kind of along the same lines, I am very, very happy that Troma has released the Toxic Avenger collection in 4K. Now, I know you're thinking, but wait a minute, weren't the Toxic Avenger movies all like shot on, you know, Super 8 and then, why would you want any of that on 4K? Because. Give me a break. It's because it's Toxic Avenger. So you get the Toxic Avenger part one, part two, part three, and then Citizen Toxie the Toxic Avenger 4. And that kind of wraps it all up. It's in a box set. It's ridiculous. These movies are just beyond stupid. It's outrageous that this whole Troma thing became their trademark franchise. But
Lloyd Kaufman. Built a whole little empire there, and frankly launched a lot of careers. Not terribly unlike your boy Roger Corman did. You know, a generation or two before.
I know a lot of people who've worked on Lloyd Kaufman films and loved every second of it. I mean, the difference is that, you know, Corman was a real filmmaker. Kaufman always understood this is kind of what I do.
Yeah, and then we got to figure out a way to make money. Yeah.
And then the last two here, the Blumhouse film, The Black Phone with Ethan Hawke on 4K, And then also on 4K, City of the Living Dead by Lucio Fulci. Lucio, this is not a proper Living Dead movie. This is Lucio Fulci just kind of stealing the title because it, I guess, wasn't sufficiently copyrighted or something. again, not a Giallo fan. You know, I don't like Argento, so I'm naturally not going to like Fulci. But look, if you like people getting their heads drilled, literally, then if you like zombies and if you like all that kind of horrible gore, yeah, I guess you'll probably get a kick out of this. I think it's a just terrible film, but yeah. You know, what do I know? It's not my genre.
Christopher George. Christopher George was this actor who was married to Linda Day George.
Oh gosh, is that I don't think I ever knew that.
Oh yeah, Linda Day George, a beautiful blonde actress from the 60s and 70s. It was in everything. And Christopher George, her husband, Christopher was in Rat Patrol.
TV series.
Yeah, he would pop up and all this kind of stuff. Just certain actors just call back memories in a certain way, and they pop up in the weirdest places. It is very strange that Christopher George was the star of a Lucio Fulci film. That just doesn't make any sense at all, but I suppose it kind of does.
Well, in the Black Phone, which is really much better shot than it has any business being, Ethan Hawke plays a killer who abducts a teenage boy, and he, you know, there's a thing with this phone where you can hear his previous victims on the phone, and it takes some interesting turns. I'm not sure it kind of earns them. I'm not sure it earns the, it's too clever by half for what it actually is, but it is interesting. And I give it credit for taking risks, even if they don't pan out. Scott Derrickson directed this, who of course did Doctor Strange, and this is kind of a big step down. I guess he did Sinister as well. Doctor Strange. So I guess this is more his genre. It is kind of in the same vein as Sinister, but I still feel like I want to give it props for taking a risk, but it doesn't really work.
Well, okay. You know, the thing that it does that bugged me, because I dug this film, I'm digging this film as a film, relatively speaking, but it has this sort of, well, I don't want to give anything away. A certain sort of supernatural twist to it. And
that's what I'm talking about.
Yeah. You know, and I'm like, okay, you know, but I'm like, we weren't in that movie. You know what I mean? But now we're in that movie and I've been enjoying the movie. So I can't say, but now we're in this other movie. And I'm like, oh, okay. Now if that's what we're doing. But you didn't say that's what we were doing.
So, and at the end of the show, I'm going to let Tim go, and I'm going to do one of our intermittent updates on some recent anime releases. There continues to be a lot of great anime, so I will I'll roll through that at the end of the show. But until then, I want to make mention of just a few MGM titles.
Okay.
Because MGM is releasing stuff again. Because MGM now belongs to Amazon.
Yeah,
I may not have necessarily realized that. So
I literally just got an email as we're speaking from Scott Fondas over at Amazon.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I wrote a piece for The Burial. The Jamie Foxx movie. He was an Amazon. Scott's a buddy of ours.
He's a film critic. He's now an executive over at Amazon.
And I wrote a great piece for The Burial because I happen to love the movie, and Scott hit me up about that. So that's weird. It literally just popped into my thing, and you mentioned that.
Well, good deal. So anyway, MGM now. So they have MGM Plus, right? It's streaming, and I don't know how they're going to reconcile that. But anyway, they're releasing a lot of MGM stuff on Blu-ray again, and they were releasing kind of intermittently through Fox, and Fox was then purchased by Disney, and then that distribution deal fell apart. So now we're getting a lot of MGM stuff coming out on Blu-ray again, and a lot of these are classics that haven't been out ever or in a long time. So I'm going to just give you the names because they're all pretty just threadbare, very simple, just Blu-ray discs with the movie. But they're worth mentioning. Michael Caine in Play Dirty, which was directed by Andre de Toff, the great Andre de Toff, good, solid kind of action genre guy. Great war film, Play Dirty. Bestseller with James Woods and Brian Dennehy was one of those cool films from the 90s that we went to junkets for. And, you know, there were a lot of these kind of thrillers. This was written, believe it or not, by Larry Cohen. One of those legit films that Larry Cohen wrote that did not become a an exploitation film.
Yeah.
Matt Dillon and Joan Chen starred in Golden Gate, which was another early 90s film. Really a pretty solid romance, and you know, a little bit of a crime angle to it. Written by David Henry Hwang, of all people, who wrote M. Butterfly. And this was, not his finest moment, but, you know, also directed by John Madden, the great British director who did wonderful work, including Her Majesty, Mrs. Judy Dench thing. Her Majesty, Mrs. Brown. Thank you.
Yes, 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 yes.
Another Matt Dillon film with James Caan, City of Ghosts, which has a wonderful performance by Stellan Skarsgård in it. This was Matt Dillon directed. Written by Matt Dillon and Barry Gifford, who at the time, and I have some connection to this because Barry Gifford also wrote Lost Highway with David Lynch, and my wife was working for Lynch at that time. So this was a lot of the same people were involved in both of these, and Deepak Nair, who my wife was working for also at the time, was one of the producers on this. So we were very carefully tracking this thing. It was shot in Cambodia, and it's a whole kind of got a whole kind of leftover Vietnam War thing, but quite well done. I don't know why Matt Dillon hasn't directed more movies, but he did a good job in that. Stormy Monday, the Mike Figgis film. What happened to Mike Figgis? Where did he go?
Good question, brother. So I mean, after being so heavy all through the 90s,
and you know, he did the score for this thing too.
Yeah, look, I don't want to put it out there, so I'm not going to say it. I was going to ask if he had one of those moments, but maybe I'm thinking of somebody else. Never mind.
Well, anyway, Roger Deakins shot this thing. It's beautifully shot. It's a good solid drama. Melanie Griffith is terrific in it. Sting is terrific in it. Mike Figgis wrote and directed and did the music, and Deakins shot it. I mean, it's Stormy Monday. It's kind of disappeared.
Well, it's leaving Las Vegas, of course. But also Internal Affairs, and one of my favorite movies, Wesley Snipes movies, One Night Stand, is Mike Figgis. Just this really great movies. And I just happened to be looking Mike up. I looked Mike up on purpose here. Mike's 75.
You should be making movies.
Yeah.
Ridley Scott's 86. Shut up.
Do your thing. Do your thing, man. Right there. Yeah.
Get back in the game. Ethan Hawke and Terry Polo in the absolutely terrible Mystery Date. But if you like Terry Polo. And if you like Ethan Hawke, I guess you'll have fun. But I thought this was an awful movie. This is a stupid movie. there it is. The Wild Party with James Coco and Raquel Welch. You know, here's the weird thing about The Wild Party. So this is from 1975. It's okay. It takes place in Hollywood, just right on the cusp of, silent films becoming talkies. And James Coco plays, a movie star who just can't kind of he thinks he still has it in gear and he doesn't really. Anyway, this is sort of like Babylon before Babylon. But the weirdest thing about this is James Ivory directed this.
Mm-hmm.
And this is an early Merchant Ivory film, and it's not at all what they should be doing. It's a little bit too unrestrained, but it is interesting as a weird entry in the Merchant Ivory canon. It doesn't fit very well, but you can sort of see that they are learning what they can do and what they can't do. So there it's kind of interesting. Diary of a Hitman with Forest Whitaker, James Belushi, Sherilyn Fenn, Sharon Stone. Another early 90s thriller. I guess Forrest Whitaker kind of took this as a paycheck, trying to build his career. I don't think he or Sharon Stone are particularly great in this thing, but they're not terrible. I don't know.
Did
you ever see it?
Oh yeah. Not that impressive.
Yeah, not great. Rosanna Arquette and Eric Roberts in Nobody's Fool. Also not a huge fan of this, but it's another one of those 90s era star vehicles, and it kind of floats by. Crime and Punishment in Suburbia from 2000 is still feels like a 90s movie. Also not great, but it's kind of in that 90s indie vein. So, you know, teen angst and lovers on the run kind of genre. It's okay. You know, it's not really Crime and Punishment. It means to be a little bit of a literary adaptation. Not really. Along the same lines is the 2002 film Crime and Punishment, which legitimately is an adaptation of Dostoevsky's novel, starring Crispin Glover and directed by Menachem Golan. And that is just very strange. Dostoevsky directed by Menachem Golan with Crispin Glover in the lead. It is weird. This movie is weird. John Hurt and Vanessa Redgrave don't.
I can see the casting of Crispin Glover, though. That's the one thing you said that, you know, I'm like, oh.
Yeah,
because he's a freak. But then again, yeah, that's interesting.
It's just strange. Golan, like, I don't know. He doesn't seem to understand the material. Redgrave doesn't seem to know what movie she's in. John Hurt, like, it looks like he just showed up for work the day before. It's very odd.
What are we doing?
Yeah, it's very odd. A movie that I had totally forgotten even existed. Another early 90s film, Crooked Hearts. With a very, very good Vincent D'Onofrio, mm-hmm. alongside a bunch of other people who just seem to be kind of phoning it in. Peter Berg, so young before he became a director. Jennifer Jason Leigh, Noel Wiley, Peter Coyote, Juliette Lewis again. You know, one of those youth movies that, you know, it's not St. Elmo's Fire. It's not the Outsiders. It didn't launch everybody's careers, but actually it has them all in it. So
yeah, they all had, exactly.
Yeah. And your guy Tak Fujimoto shot it and did a great job.
Yeah.
And then the last two here, The Big Knife, a great Robert Aldrich movie, from 1955, a really good solid noir with Jack Palance just being tough as nails and Rod Steiger being even more tough. And it's got a whole Hollywood angle to it, right? It's it's Hollywood as racketeering, and it's great. And then it even gets even better when Shelley Winters shows up. It's fantastic. Mm. I love everything about this movie. It's based on a play by Odets. And I just think everything just perfectly works here. Shelley Winters, great. Steiger's great. Jack Palance is great. Ida Lupino even shows up in the movie. So The Big Knife, good, solid genre piece from its day. And then, even better, Go Tell the Spartans with Burt Lancaster. Which directed by a guy named Ted Post, who didn't do a whole lot of other stuff, but this was one of the first great movies about the Vietnam War. 1977. It's pre Apocalypse Now and pre Deer Hunter, post John Wayne's absolutely horrible Green Berets. So this is the first one that really goes there, and it paves the way for the others. And I think it's an absolutely terrific film. Burt Lancaster, Go Tell the Spartans, really, really good. Really good movie. All of that stuff from MGM now, out of the MGM library.
Yeah, man.
Shall we hit some TV?
Yeah, dude. Let's go to the TV stuff. Let's see. What do you want to start at? What do you got down there?
We can do the NCIS thing because we've got two of these. Oh,
the complete Los Angeles set, oh, I think, gosh. Is there.
Yeah, right. They finally brought this thing to a close. And it's funny, these people whose careers just take a sideways turn. Like, you know, Christopher.
If you had told me LL Cool J in 19, when he was doing it and doing it and doing it, if you had told me that at the end of the day, LL's bones would be made from X number of years, I think 2009 is when the series started.
Yeah.
on NCIS.
14 years, 14 seasons.
You know, yeah. And, so there you go, man.
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, and the franchise keeps going, because we're also going to talk about here is NCIS Hawaii season 2. So even though they brought L.A. to a close after 14 years, we're two seasons into NCIS Hawaii. So they're not letting this go anytime soon. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it's weird. If you'd said to me at a certain point, like back in the 80s, you'd pointed to, you know, LL with his hat and Ice-T with his Cop Killer song and everything.
Chris O'Donnell running around with Pacino.
I know. If you had said to me, okay, those two hip hop artists, they're going to spend most of their careers playing cops. Wait a minute. No. But Ice-T and Cop Killer is like, no. Trust me. Both of them are going to play their entire careers playing cops. And that wussy guy in Scent of a Woman. Yeah. What about him? He's going to be one of their partners. No, get away from me.
Oh, it's crazy.
After he bombs as Robin. What do you mean Robin? Robin in Batman Robin? That guy? No, shut up. Really? Who knows? You can never predict these things. You can't.
No. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And look, yeah, Sherman did an NCIS. Now that I think about it, just popped into my head. A buddy of ours. These shows, and not just this one, the NCISs, the Law and Orders, there's a whole, and they just sort of like came out of nowhere. That didn't happen when you and I came up watching television and television. That didn't happen. Show happened, it had its run, and then it was done. Yeah. And if the creators of that show had another show, it would be, Stephen Boschko, he did Hill Street Blues,
yeah,
and then he did, Cop Rock, and that was, and then he did, whatever the other one was.
Yeah, okay, Cop Rock, dude, I forgot about that. Remind me, why did you remind me?
I was like one of the few people who thought that was a well executed, if poorly conceived show. Did it ever come out?
I don't think that ever came out.
Peanut Onorati and a few other people. Oh, I wonder. Because the musical productions were excellent on that show. I don't care what anybody says. But then this started to happen, and now here, they turn them over, but that's a new thing that started to happen with that series of shows, Law and Orders and these and so on.
Well, anyway, I mean, it's a giant box set on NCIS Los Angeles. 14 years that came and went so quickly. Chris O'Donnell and LL. It has a lot of good episodes. It does. I'll be honest. Linda Hunt is great on this show.
Yeah.
She kills it. She's, who knew that she'd wind up on a cop show, but she does. And, it's got 17 hours of special features, 14 seasons, 81 discs, 320 episodes. Just, if you're a fan, get it, sit it on the shelf, watch an episode a day. It'll last you the rest of your life.
Yeah,
it's like when they, on those game shows, when they go, a lifetime supply of shampoo. This is a lifetime supply of NCIS Los Angeles.
Yeah.
And then we have the second season of NCIS Hawaii, which they, they put the apostrophe in there correctly before the last I, which nobody else does. They want to be legit. So it's Hawaii.
Yeah, authentic. Yeah.
Authentic, more so than Hawaii 5-0, which won't do that. So that's what I think they're doing. They're just, it's, I think it's, thumbing your nose at Hawaii 5-0. Oh, Hawaii 5-0? Well, we're NCIS Hawaii.
So we got it right.
We got it right. Anyway, you know what? Here's the thing about this, and I've only seen a few episodes. I've only, just sampled it a little bit. But I do like the fact that it feels more legit to the whole idea of the NCIS. It feels like that operation belongs more in Hawaii than here. You know what I mean? Right. Because it's like, naval, and it just feels like that. Like it feels like it's home. It feels like it belongs there. And, the whole idea here is there's like, it deals with RIMPAC, which is the Rim of Pacific Exercises, which is kind of it's a military exercise thing that goes on. So it all feels very much connected to the military in ways that I think other NCIS have not necessarily. So this is 22 episodes, 6 discs, second season. Feels like the show, it's not running on fumes. It's not like Law and Order or, CSI, where they just kept inventing it over and over. It really does feel like it's come home somewhere.
Mm.
Let's talk about some of these other cop shows, as long as we're off on that particular thing. Blue Bloods is now in its 13th season.
Whoa.
It's been in more episodes of this than he was on Magnum P.I. That's
crazy.
13 years of Blue Bloods?
That is just, hey, and Tom, I got to tell you, Tom will always be my one and only Magnum PI. I know the other kid, plays Magnum over. But Tom, I still, when I think about Tom Selleck, I still think about him in terms of Magnum PI. And then after that little movie career that he had there, in the middle, quickly down under Mr. Baseball or whatever it was, stuff like that. There are a few of those that I really, really like too. I've really only seen maybe 2-3 episodes of Blue Bloods, 13 years of episodes notwithstanding. Yeah.
Well, Larry Minetti shows up as a guest star in this.
Oh, great! Yeah,
a little bit of a Magnum reunion, but it's a solid series, and Selleck he holds it down. We've also got season 3 of The Equalizer. I still can't quite figure out how they, we're doing the movies. And we're also doing the TV show. And we've got Denzel doing the movies, and we've got Latifah doing the TV show.
Robin. Her name is Robin McCall.
Yes.
As opposed to, Robert McCall.
Yeah. So I guess it's the same problem I had with The Flash, which is how do you explain that you're doing the movies and how? I don't.
Yeah.
Maybe I expect too much. Anyway, how do we feel about this TV show?
Again, I've only seen maybe 3 or 4 episodes of the show. What season are we in about?
This is the third season. Yeah. On the DVD, show. Not Blu-ray, DVD.
I know it has an audience that really, really likes it. But when I think about these things, I'm sorry. They have a context so far as I'm concerned. Now, certainly it is fair to note that we moved from The Equalizer of 1985 and older English gentleman, white English gentleman, to Denzel, a brother. So it's not like these things can't do that. They can do it.
Oh yeah. What's great about The Equalizer is you can twist it any number of different ways. It doesn't belong to any particular nationality, to men, to women. It's a psychology. It's the psychology of the person who is the equalizer. And you can really adapt that to a lot of different ways. So I like the malleability of it. I hate to say this, I almost don't feel like the show is like the movies pushed it into a really graphic place, like a really intense place. And I don't know that the TV series can go there. And so it almost feels like the movies raised the bar and the TV show can't live up to it.
Well, they can't. The television show is static. She's got a kid. She's got a home. She's in a place. The movies, well, the last one, where were they? In Italy? Sicily, I believe, or something like that?
Yeah, yeah. No. It was Sicily, yeah.
So that's it's sort of a different dynamic in the movies. Sometimes for me, it's just a matter of the title, you just call it something else. I think it would make me happier.
We've also got Your Honor season 2 with Bryan Cranston, who I guess is taking a break again. Is he taking a break again from acting?
I think I heard something about that. Your Honor.
I think he's taking a break. So I don't know that we're going to get any further seasons, but this is from Showtime. And he's worked a lot, but over the last, 20 years or whatever, he's worked a lot. So I think he's taken a break and, he's an old judge who's been disbarred and, that's what Bryan Cranston does. He plays people who are either dying and disgraced or both dying and disgraced. So, that's kind of what he does. He plays dark people. But it's an interesting psychological study, not sure it's I'm kind of tired of judges and lawyer shows a little bit. Then we also have the series Darrow and Darrow, the complete collection. This is 4 Darrow and Darrow murder mysteries from the Hallmark movies and mysteries line. And the only thing that I find enjoyable about this, I like British mysteries a lot more because they're just more serious and, but there's something about, I don't know. How do I put this? It's the Hallmark and mystery don't really go together, do they?
No, not in my mind. Yeah, no.
Yeah, and one of
the maybe a little Agatha Christie or something, but not that's. I don't know.
Yeah, no, it is what it is. But anyway, no, there's 4 of these on here: Darrow and Darrow, In the Key of Murder, Body of Evidence, Witness to Murder, and it's a little bit, kind of heart to heart ish. I guess if that is, it's a little bit in that vein. A lot of guest stars, a lot of fun, but not necessarily my speed. It's like it's wannabe British stuff. And then The Lincoln Lawyer, season one, which is taking the Matthew McConaughey movie, which is also based on a book, and detouring it into a series. And I kind of think, you know, this is only 10 episodes. It's like a streaming arc. I kind of think this works better. And I like the movie. I like the McConaughey movie. But I also think this works a little bit better in on TV.
Mm. More narratives, more stories. The Lincoln, the main one in the movie, the Matthew McConaughey movie from 2011. You have yourself a single storyline going there. Here, you've got several different little storylines that pop up, plus the whole relationship, with the ex-wife and all that stuff, played by the extraordinary Nev Campbell. So can't go wrong with that.
And I also feel like it's not so, I mean, my problem with these shows is usually they're too courtroom bound. And this one's not so courtroom bound that it makes me feel claustrophobic and I hate the wood paneling. Mm. And some of them are. The complete series of Pennyworth, I thought this would actually do better. This is 7 discs. I thought, okay, let's take Alfred and make him a hero unto himself, give him a backstory, make him a, British SAS guy in 60s in London and do a bit of a James Bond thing. And, that'll expand the whole Gotham universe. And it never really caught on for some reason.
Well, it didn't really make any sense. And most of that had to do when they brought in all of the things to connect Alfred to the Wayne family. Yeah. So when they bring in Thomas Wayne and his wife, and they try to make them all kinds of different people, when it's living in the world of just Alfred Pennyworth and just the English people doing what they were doing and sort of East Ender sort of dynamic or whatever, that was all kind of interesting. But when they had to sort of Batman it up, they had to connect it back to the Batman dynamic. Now we're just making stuff up.
Succession, after the fourth season, now you can get it as the fourth and final season, or you can get the whole bloody thing. And this show just kind of came out of nowhere, and it put Brian Cox over the top like nobody's business. I mean, Jeremy Strong and Brian Cox were always good actors that we all followed, but like this show just suddenly they were stars. It took two guys who'd been really workaday actors for a long time, and it just made them overnight stars. I mean, it's Dallas, isn't it? Isn't this just Dallas?
Yeah, well, Dallas, it's interesting. Dallas is funny now when you watch it, when I watch it. If you watch the episodes of Dallas from the late 70s and whatnot, they're kind of funny. At the time, they didn't know they were funny, and I don't know that I thought of them as particularly funny. But if you watch Dallas, now this show knows that it's funny.
Yeah.
And while it is working really hard to be extremely brutal and serious and all of that, behind it all, it knows that it's funny. And I think that's the thing. I didn't watch this show all that much, to be honest with you. I think that the real world that this show is mirroring, the world with Rupert Murdoch and Fox News and all of the other things sort of that spin around that is far and away funnier. more dramatic too than this show could be. So I would find myself watching this, and then I would go and read the news, and I'd be like, nope, the real world won. I'm just gonna stick over there.
Really good series from this is a Norwegian series called Aber Bergen. And it's a legal drama. It's really worth checking out. At like most of these foreign language shows, this is from MHZ Choice. And you can see it, you can watch their streaming platform, or you can get it on DVD. And this is the complete series of Aber Bergen, which is, I think, an incredibly well-written show. And really, really, I mean, it's paced like a Scandinavian show, like you would expect. But you know what? There's something really wonderful and exotic about the look inside a legal system that is totally alien to ours. And these are a couple of defense lawyers, and there's a little bit of a real life Spencer Tracy, Catherine Hepburn thing.
Oh, Mike and what was it?
Adam's Rib was
Adam's Rib. Rib.
There's a little bit of that going on here, but it is it's quite good. It doesn't. It's not comedy. It's straight up drama. So it's like if it's, you know, a Norwegian Adam's Rib series, if it were played straight. There you go.
Yeah.
But anyway, it's really good. It's not just about the legal stuff. It's about the relationship, and it's very, very well written. So Aber Bergen, the complete series, worth checking out. And then we've also got The New Walker, season 3. I'm sorry, without Chuck Norris.
The whole point of Walker is Chuck Norris.
But here's what's dumb. I don't know. Did I say dumb? I mean, here's what's awesome.
Yeah.
Awesome. So we've got Walker Independence, the complete series. And we get this, and this is on DVD.
Oh, yeah.
I thought, Walker Independence, what is this? And it's the origin story of Walker.
About the Walker of the Walker clan.
The Walker clan is about Abby Walker, the matriarch, and her husband is murdered. And, you know, now we know where Walker comes from. And I was thinking to myself, you know, I never saw a single episode of the original Chuck Norris Walker where I thought to myself, I wonder what this guy is. Like, never. At no point did I ever. So, and then I realized, oh, they're just doing doing the Yellowstone thing.
Sure. Yeah.
Of course, you know, Yellowstone is obsessed. Well, Paramount is obsessed with having the Yellowstone universe keep expanding and expanding. And, you know, it's because Taylor Sheridan has signed $150 million deal, whatever, $10 billion deal. I don't know.
But he's
making a lot of money to keep making shows and writing them all. So they keep expanding Yellowstone. He had 1889 or 5 or whatever it was. And now there's 1923 with Harrison Ford and Helen Mirren. A Yellowstone origin story, because there are now multiple origin stories.
Yeah.
Anyway, I keep hearing how great these origin stories are. I don't know. Not really.
Yeah. It's a thing that is done now. Yeah. It's relatively speaking new. I've never been much for origin stories in the first place. Just broadly speaking, no matter what it's applied to, and origin story is almost always a little bit anticlimactic, because you know all the stuff that happens after, because you know there was the previous movie, so you know who's going to make it, and you know who's not, but I don't know. Now people are into their origin stories. To me, the origin stories needs to happen in the original story. Is when you can tell me about the origin.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Yes. Precisely. Let's burn through some of the rest of these real quickly, so we can give everybody their TV bite, and then I'll get into the anime stuff. Tom Clancy's Jack Ryan season 3. Wearing thin.
Well, to be honest with you, I was not much of a fan of this particular incarnation of Jack Ryan. I'm like you. I go back to Jack Ryan. You know, Tom Clancy's actual Jack Ryan on that boat, Hunt for Red October, and then Alec Baldwin did what? Who was it? It was Alec Baldwin and Ben Affleck.
Yep.
And then is that the movies, right? Alec Baldwin's and a Ben Affleck.
Harrison Ford.
Oh, Harrison Ford and Alec Baldwin Ben Affleck. Yeah. That's what it is. Okay. And then, you know, and now this whole TV, and I'm like, you know what? I think I'm good too.
You know what else I'm good on? I see Couples Therapy season 3 on Showtime. So I watch a few of these episodes and I realize this is why I like the Bob Newhart show, because I need to laugh at people who are in therapy. I know that sounds cruel, but I really need to laugh at these people. I can't deal with a dramatic show about people who are like in therapy.
It's
too intense. It's too tough. It's
like in therapy. I don't want to do that.
I need Bill Daly being neurotic. I've been watching a lot of I Dream of Jeannie lately, dude.
I've been watching
a lot of old I Dream of Jeannie episodes.
Can't go wrong.
My goodness. It's just, They got three seasons on Tubi.
And Barbara's still kicking with us, right, Barbara?
Oh my gosh.
I think she's still funny.
She is. She absolutely is. I think she's 90 now.
Yeah.
Fire Country season 1, you know, more firemen. I don't know. I don't know if this really is, if this is needed. I mean, we've got, you know, so many fire shows. I don't know.
Well, look, cops, doctors, lawyers, Now, you know, you fancy fireman. I don't know. It's the same genre, no matter where you set it. It's all the same
way back
genre.
To emergency. All the way back to emergency one. Yeah. I mean, as a survivor of multiple wildfires, I have a hard time watching this kind of stuff. I just do. So Help Me, Todd, season one. You know, this is another CBS Paramount thing. I feel like Glenn Gordon Caron should, you know what I mean? Right. Yeah. It needs his special touch on this. It's, you know, about a guy who's, you know, kind of an amateur who becomes a private eye and winds up working with his mom. And, the whole chemistry of it, it just needed that Remington Steele moonlighting-y thing, right? It just...
Well, Marcia Gay Harden and Skylar Astin, both of whom I like, I mean, you obviously love Marcia Gay, but mostly they're just sort of like doing a mother-son irritating thing as opposed to, you know, so I don't know. Yeah, there you go, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I don't... Yeah, I get it. And then, let's see, Smiling Friend season one, an Adult Swim show, which like most Adult Swim just feels to me like somebody took way too many hard drugs, came up with something and somebody, guaranteed it, you know, some kind of a run. I don't know if this deserves to have a season two. I know these things, like people love the Adult Swim stuff. I don't know. But these are 8 episodes in this very, very strange, otherworldly, weird, animated series. It's odd. It's just weird. It goes right up there with Aqua Teen Hunger Force. It's like they're trying to make it the new one of those. The Neighborhood is into its 5th season. I'm thrilled for Cedric. It's still funny. I just don't know where this is gonna go. It feels like maybe they should, you know, just, I don't know, I'll move on to a different show at some point.
I call it affable television. It's absolutely affable television.
That's a great title.
It's one of the few shows that's not one of the few, but actually it is one of the few that's still shot on a classic TV set where even the outside scenes are still on the TV set.
You're right.
When they're in the front yard or in the yard, they're still on a set. They're just on that set. And man, I got to tell you, that's old school filmmaking right there. Like that's Lucy and Desi type stuff.
That's great. No, that's true. That's true. Lucy and Desi when they moved to Connecticut. Everything outdoors in Connecticut was over on stage 6.
It was over on stage 6, baby.
Yeah, no, that for sure. Or Green Acres. The whole freaking Pixley is on a stage somewhere.
I love it.
And then 6 seasons of Rick and Morty, complete seasons 1 through 6 with a free poster inside. You know, this, I guess it, this is as weird as I'm willing to settle for a show. This has a lot of extras on it, commentaries, animatics, deleted scenes, sketches, and, you know, featurettes and whatnot. Rick and Morty has, you know, it's not for everybody, but it's got a lot of memorable episodes. So, you know, if you like individual episodes, it might be worth it. We also have season 5 of Cobra Kai. I still can't believe this show has made it that far. That they got 5 episodes out of this, 5 series, seasons out of this concept of bringing back the Karate Kid. But there it is, Cobra Kai, 5 seasons. Who'd have thought? I mean, did you ever think this thing would go that long?
Now, man, particularly the way it started. I mean, they kind of bootlegged it up onto YouTube or whatever the hell they did for $1.95. And bit by bit by bit, and there you go. Now the kid, and you know, one of the kids from the show is the Blue Beetle or something like that, and one of the Marvel kids or something.
Yeah. And I mean, it's, you know, the whole thing here is, I mean, somehow the whole rivalry, they keep, you know, the Cobra Kai business complex. They keep pushing it. And somehow they're making this rivalry work where I thought 2 movies done, you know, 1 and like 2 and done. Right. That's what I always thought. But there it is. It keeps going. And then last 4 here real quickly. We got Scooby-Doo and Crypto 2, an original movie where Scooby-Doo makes friends with and teams up with Crypto, Superman's dog. There is a history in Scooby-Doo of doing weird stuff like this, where they team up with the Harlem Globetrotters and
the Three Stooges. Batman and Robin.
So they already teamed up with Batman and Robin. Why wouldn't they team up with Crypto? I guess. it's silly, but it's a new movie and the kids will love it. Martin Scorsese and David Tedeschi did their Showtime original Personality Crisis, One Night Only, which is a
fascinating.
It's a David Johansen, aka Buster Poindexter portrait. The guy has lived one hell of a life. He really has, and it is it's very impressive. Ellen Kuras, who DP'd it, one of the best DPs working for independent film. She's won, awards at Sundance numerous times. So, you really are produced by Brian Grazer and Ron Howard. So everybody's kind of on board here to kind of give this really amazing portrait of David Johansen, which is basically a portrait of the New York Dolls moment and everyone who came out of that glam rock period into the present. It's a much more expansive portrait than just the one guy, but he's kind of the linchpin that holds it all together.
Well, yeah, I mean, you're sort of built all around this one show, at this cabaret club there. But it's really, what I loved in that movie was all the great footage that Martin found of the Dolls and frankly, David and maybe pre-Dolls. And as you just said, because you're talking about these people at this time in New York, you by extension get Basquiat and Warhol and all of these other people that were just part and parcel of that. What's interesting to me, we look at David Johansen, now or in the last 30, 40 years or whatever, it's David Johansen, just Buster, all that kind of stuff. Yeah. But we forget that of the Dolls, of the New York Dolls, he was the prettiest. He was flat out gorgeous as a young, and maybe we all are, but man, he was a good looking fella. He was David Bowie good looking.
Yeah.
Yeah. So what are you gonna,
And then to wrap it out, we got a couple from History Channel. History's Greatest of All Time with Peyton Manning. Not anybody's idea of a host, but why not? Sure. This is just a, 8-episode series looking at anybody who might be a greatest of all time in any particular discipline. And, it's interesting. I don't necessarily agree with all the conclusions, but it is an engaging. It's one of those engaging kind of novelty shows, those novelty documentary shows.
Yeah.
And speaking of Ancient Aliens season 17, I don't know, Tim, how many more aliens do we? Can we? I mean, 17 seasons of Ancient Aliens.
Oh, this is a forever situation. Every few years, we are given a reason to think about these things again, and that, sir, means that Ancient Aliens is a forever situation.
My gosh!
Hey, look, I contributed to it as much as anybody else. I watch all those Stargate series.
Well, look, I grew up on all that Eric Von Daniken stuff, right? Chariots of the Gods. The Outer Space Connection. I was a little kid. I made my mother take me to those things. I want to see those movies because they're all about aliens. And I know I saw Flying Saucer the other day. I know I saw one. Anyway, sure, why not? 17 seasons of Ancient Aliens. Yeah, but at some point, they're going to run out of either aliens or ancient artifacts to try to pretend they have something to do with aliens. You got to run out at some point.
Oh, boy.
Got to call it quits. Anyway, with that, I'll let Tim go and I will
do right,
anime. Checks out cinegods.com, digigods.com, and we're starting to enter award season here. So, but we'll be back probably after Halloween or perhaps Halloween week. Halloween's early in the week, so it might be early November, but we will see everybody back in a few weeks.
Bye-bye.
All right, and we're just going to wrap the old show up with a few anime recommendations. There's been a lot of anime released recently, and it continues to be one of the most successful and consistently in demand of the genres that continue to thrive on disc. Much of everything else is moving to streaming, but anime on disc continues to be very, very popular. I'm going to just make mention of some stuff that is... I've separated everything out here into several groups, and I'm saving the highly recommended stuff for last. There's some stuff here that is these are franchises, probably stuff that we've talked about in the past. So I'm just going to roll through some of the franchise stuff first, just to let you know that it's here. We have the second season of the Demon Girl Next Door, which is like almost all of these, almost all this stuff is based on either graphic novels or manga or video games, or in many cases, they are these giant multimedia franchises where there are television and movies and video games and manga and books, and they all kind of fuel each other. So anyway, Demon Girl Next Door is manga based, and that recently last year had its second season. So she and her cute little horns are out there once again. We've also got the complete series of To Love Rue, which is available now, all 64 episodes in a boxed set Blu-ray with a new English dubbed edition. I would recommend you listen to it in the original Japanese. Just feels better. The voices match better. But, you know, it's that has a following as well. We also have the complete season one and season two of Madaka Box. That is something we have talked about as well in the past. That also is based on manga, and the that goes back about a decade. I think recently we mentioned Girls in Panzer. We now have the TV series and the six OVAs on three discs, Blu-ray. So if you like your girls in schoolgirls in tanks, as some people in the anime audience do, there you go. And then Tokyo Mew Mew New. Not just Tokyo Mew Mew, but Tokyo Mew Mew New. It's 24 episodes that were aired just recently, ended up middle of the summer. This is the season one collection, and it is on Blu-ray based on the manga of the same name. The manga was made like at least 20 years ago. And, you know, it's some fun, girl power and alien fighting. So, that will eventually have a complete set as well. So if you just want to keep up, go ahead and get it. But otherwise, there will be future seasons and, a boxed set somewhere down the line. We've also got, this very interesting expansion on the Utano Princess Sama series, which is, you know, video games and films and TV and the whole thing. This is Utano Princess Sama Maji Love Starish Tours. These long titles. But, you know, it is, again, in this boy band world and you know, pop music, anime pop music, and huge following for this entire franchise. And this is probably some of the better stuff in the franchise. So that's for fans only, but a nice entry in the franchise. And then also kind of related to that is Watcha Primagi. Primagi is this competitive multi-entertainment thing. It's you know, it's songs and dance and costumes and all the rest of this stuff. And it's originally a video game, a very popular video game in Japan, I am told. And you get 51 episodes on six discs in this Blu-ray set, which is just exploding with cute girl power and psychedelic animation and all kinds of crazy character design and costume design. Skews very young, but you know, it's for young girls in particular, probably a great deal of fun. Then the next batch of titles here, these all kind of live in a particular world, that is the world of wish fulfillment for students. This is all about the world of students and student experiences and school and oftentimes supernatural adventures. A huge following in the anime world, a huge genre unto itself, skews very teenage. But I'm just going to go through some of the titles that are new here. These are all complete collections, most of them from Sentai. Immoral Guild, which is, you know, skews a little bit older in the age range. Call of the Night is actually really well animated. This is vampire themed stuff. Kind of some really very interesting artwork in that one. Skewing much younger is Keep Your Hands Off Izouken, Eizouken, exclamation point. Don't forget the exclamation point. That's, you know, more of a kind of preteen thing. This aired a couple of years ago in around 2020, I think it was. But, it has, it's kind of an internally self-reflexive story about kids and loving anime. And, it's, the comedy is not universal. It, again, skews very preteen. We've also got Vermeil in Gold, V-E-R-M-E-I-L. High School of the Dead, which is actually pretty cool. Again, that's kind of older teen, young adult skewing. When Will Ayumu Make His Move? Really kind of standard teen stuff. My Isekai Life, I-S-E-K-I-A-I. Girlish Number, The Complete Collection. This is all on Blu-ray. Triage X, The Complete Collection. Busu Shinki, Armored War Goddess, which is absolutely a blast to watch. This is really one of the most enjoyable of all of these. It's kind of a dash of mecha in the teen wish fulfillment saga, and it's really, really great. It's kind of it's kind of crossover. Girls and boys would love it. It's good for even preteens all the way to young adults. Fantasista Doll, more kind of tween oriented. The Executioner and Her Way of Life, great girl power, girl empowerment stuff. The movie collection for Recycle of the Penguin Drum. This is really kind of an interesting thing. I'm not familiar with the whole Penguin Drum saga, the what precedes this. But it's excellent animation. It's very, very strong writing, and it's Recycle, Recycle. But it's it has some narrative strains that sort of connect to some mecha stuff. But it's the mysterious the fantasy of it orients about this hat, this almost magical hat, which is the key to all of the adventures and the mystery. The one I want to spend a moment talking about is Lonely Castle in the Mirror. Lonely Castle in the Mirror is absolutely beautiful. This is the only one of these. The others are all from the Sente Library through Section 23. This one is from G-Kids and Shout Studios, and it's just really, really top-tier anime. This is from the director Kaichi Hara, who previously did Miss Hosokai, and it is based on a graphic novel that is apparently also quite beloved, of the same name, Lonely Castle in the Mirror. And it's about a young girl who finds this mysterious portal, almost like Chronicles of Narnia like, in the mirror in her bedroom. And six of her friends join her on her Narnia-like journey, and it borrows a lot from Chronicles of Narnia, but it also has a flavor all of its own. It has a style all of its own that is very, very uniquely anime, and it's quite beautiful. So it's Lonely Castle in the Mirror, really, really well worth checking out. And then, as long as we're on the G-Kids front, let's move to some of the more original and interesting stuff. A bunch of great, great other G-Kids titles here, starting with Demo Memorial Keys. This is from 2021, and it's based on a Taiwanese game, but it doesn't have a lot of the weaknesses that you often have with anime that is game-based. It doesn't feel as though somebody's just trying to stretch a story and adapt it. It's about this very, very unusual girl named Demo, who lives alone and plays her piano in this remote castle. And she makes friends one day with another mysterious girl who has amnesia and who just shows up from seemingly nowhere. And their adventure is what constitutes the story, and it is visually absolutely captivating and hypnotic, and the story is a little bit out there, but it's not so much so that you can't sort of suspend your disbelief and kind of go along with it. It's really quite lovely. We also have Blue Thermal. which is in the sports genre. You know, you got a lot of these animes that are about basketball teams and other sports teams and baseball teams. And this kind of connects two of those things. It's you know, about a girl who was very, very much into volleyball, and now she's segueing to gliders, small plane gliders. And it's wish fulfillment. It's kind of teen wish fulfillment, but it uses that as a metaphor for other things and other coming of age aspects of growing up. It's quite nice. The fantastic Inu O by Masaki Yuasa. This is fabulous. This was in the this was very highly regarded in our LAFCA voting some years back, and it's really, really totally off the wall, but it's absolutely excellent. It is like, it is a, maybe this is the best way of putting it, this is as if someone made a feudal Japanese anime in as a musical or as a rock opera. The music's great. The animation is terrific. The story is absolutely captivating. And somehow it doesn't feel weird or goofy. It just feels totally appropriate. And it's really worth checking out. It's beautifully done in all respects. Yuasa has done, you know, a number of great films before. Walk On Girl, one of them. So this is also from G Kids. Excellent on Blu-ray. Well worth examining. A little bit more on the really out there stuff is the 3D animated New Gods Yang Jian. This is 3D animation. This is CGI animation, so it's not traditional anime, but it's Chinese made, so it's anime influenced, but it's Chinese made. Directors are Zhao Ji and Mu Chuan. And this is sort of it's based on a novel that was written during the Ming Dynasty, but it feels like anime that is feudal but transported to a Chinese setting. So even though it is set in the Ming Dynasty and it has a wuxia feel to it, it also has a very anime feel to it. So it's really kind of fusing the influences of both, and pretty cool. It's pretty cool. Mystical and fantastical, and all the best stuff from all these different genres. So give that one a look. New Gods Yang Jian, really worth checking out. And then the last one of the G Kids front is Unicorn Wars, which is again not anime, but it's anime influenced. This is a Spanish. This is kind of like a Spanish anime, is the best way to put it. Directed by Alberto Vasquez, and it takes place in a very strange universe where teddy bears and unicorns are at war, and you got to roll with it because it really is enthralling and magical and funny all at the same time. And there's so much other weird stuff that goes on in this world. And it's a real trip. It's a real trip. It might be a little bit intense for younger children, but teens will absolutely have a blast with it. Families will have a blast with it. It's totally family friendly. Nothing weird about it in the extreme. Back to some of the Sente titles. We've got The Life of, as long as we're in the weird anthropomorphized animal genre. I'm going to talk here for a second about The Life of Bidori Gusuko, which was made about 10 years ago or so, also based on a graphic novel that was very, very popular in Japan. And previously, I think the original novel goes all the way back pre-World War II. In any case, it is about kind of these rabbit-like creatures that live in the mountains, and the entire story is a bit of a metaphor for modernization and wrestling with the alienation of the modern world. But it feels also at the same time very Dickensian. It feels a little bit like, I guess in some ways, like the animation intersection of Peter Rabbit and Oliver Twist. How's that for an unusual fusion? We've also got Made in Abyss, The Golden City of the Scorching Sun. This is kind of a semi-sequel to the first season of Made in Abyss. And this recently aired on television in Japan. It is now here on Blu-ray. And some people may have already seen it on television. I think it's had some streaming here. Anyway, it's 12 episodes on two discs. And it skews younger. It is magical quest stuff for younger kids. And, you know, you kind of need to have a little bit of background in Made in Abyss. You're not going to be able to pick up on their magical quest journey if you don't have a backdrop in what previously was told in the story. On the Lupin front, because a new season of Lupin is now on Netflix, starring Omar Sy, but the original Lupin, the great French thief that inspired that and also inspired the Lupin anime, is now the source of Lupin Zero. This is the complete collection, 6 episodes, all of it set in the 1960s, and it's a lot of fun. It's a lot of fun. It's both anime and it pays tribute to the whole Lupin world. The everything that's fun about the thieves and the caper stuff that it has a little bit of a James Bond quality to it because it's set in the 1960s. So if you're watching Lupin on Netflix, if you're watching Omar's Lupin, it's worth checking this out as well, because it's all part of the overall Lupin universe. And it's fun how many different cultures and genres and media all wrap themselves around that lore. It's very, very engaging. And then lastly, we have the complete series of Majestic Prince, which is also one of these giant franchises that spans anime and manga and video games and everything else. And it's set about 100 years in the future. It is a wonderful, wonderful mecha entry. It is, I think, one of the best new mecha. And it borrows, obviously, liberally from a lot of the mecha stuff that has preceded it. But it really has a great 21st century spin on, at least it's 22nd century, but, you know, obviously created in the 21st century. And there's a little bit of Arthur C. Clarke stuff in here, too. There's a lot from Childhood's End, Arthur C. Clarke's Childhood's End, that's sort of been adapted for the mecha environment here. And I think that's very smart and very cool. These what they call the evolved children. So very, very engaging. Majestic Prince, the complete series. That is worth checking out as well. All right. Thanks for tuning in. We will see you guys probably sometime after Halloween, early November, and we'll have a lot of great new material to talk for you at that time.